USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is none other than Ali Soufan, CEO of the Soufan Group, an international strategic consulting firm based in New York City. And we're coming to you from his office in New York on the sidelines of the 74th annual meeting of the UN General Assembly. Ali, of course, is no stranger to these VOA microphones. We have interviewed him on numerous occasions on the sidelines of the UNGA. He is a leading national security and counterterrorism expert and continues to play a significant advisory role on today's most urgent issues. A former supervisory FBI agent, Ali Soufan, investigated and supervised highly sensitive and complex international terrorism cases, including the East Africa embassy bombing, the attack on the USS Cole, and the events surrounding 9/11. Ali Soufan also serves as a member of the Homeland Security Advisory Council. He is the author of the newly released book, The Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. He also wrote a New York Times top 10 bestseller, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. A native of Lebanon who immigrated to the United States, Ali Soufan served on the front lines against Al-Qaeda and gained an international reputation as a top counterterrorism operative and interrogator. He has spent more than two decades investigating and analyzing Al-Qaeda and its offshoots. But he is witnessing and documenting another transnational threat, violent white supremacist extremism. We'll discuss his thoughts on this growing global threat, as well as elicit his assessment of the recent revelations swirling around U.S. President Donald Trump that have prompted the House of Representatives to launch an impeachment inquiry. Ali Soufan, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you again.
And thanks, as always, for hosting us right here in your office. Well, Ali, I want to talk to you about the global rise of radical right-wing extremism and the white supremacist movement. I had the pleasure of just sitting and participating in a seminar that we had this week that your group sponsored about this threat. You were on Capitol Hill recently testifying just as we were commemorating the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And, of course, I'd like you to talk about the global rise of right-wing extremism, which basically manifests itself as white nationalism. Discuss your recent findings in the report.
For a few years, we've been monitoring this new phenomena. And what we do in the center here, we focus on trend lines and we try to predict which trend lines might be fault lines down the future. And that's frankly why we started to monitor what came to be ISIS early on, or the foreign fighters. We were the first entity to collect numbers on foreign fighters, and that wasn't popular. And even in our own government, because the focus at the time back in 2012, 2013 was to just focus on Assad. And later on, the foreign fighters phenomena in Syria developed into being a major contributor to instability in the world. Now we're seeing a new phenomena developing, and it's a white supremacist extremism. And what made us very concerned about it is it's evolving in a similar way to the jihadi threats in the 80s and 90s. So it's a transnational in nature. A lot of people, when we talk about neo-Nazis or white supremacists, they think it's a domestic terrorism issue in the United States. Yes, there is domestic monsters, but they have tentacles in so many different Western countries, all the way from New Zealand to Australia to Ukraine to all the countries in Western Europe to the United States. This network is operating, as I mentioned, in a similar way to the jihadis, but also at the same time, they are copying the jihadis. For example, there is a white supremacist group in the United States. Their name is The Base. The Base mean Al-Qaeda. They copy Al-Qaeda. They actually copy even Al-Qaeda's manuals. They put images of Osama bin Laden. We started to see a movement in promoting the idea of violence to purify Western society from all non-white influences, from Jewish influences, very similar to the jihadis wanted to purify their societies from any un-Islamic influence. So there's a lot of similarities in the way they recruit, in the way they see violence as very justifiable to meet their goals, in the way they fundraise, the way they travel overseas. For example, we always saw the jihadis going to conflicts, taking advantage of conflicts in order to build networks, training, experience, to recruit. We've seen them doing it in Afghanistan against the Soviets, and then in the Balkans. We've seen it in Somalia. We've seen it in so many different countries around the world, recently in Syria. And we've seen the same thing happening with the white supremacist extremism. They are using the conflict in the Ukraine in a similar way to how the jihadis use the conflict that I just mentioned to beef their own ranks.
So I'd like to talk about the role of Ukraine and Russia in particular, because what you're saying is, just like the foreign fighters, whether from Europe, perhaps less so from the United States, were attracted to Syria and to Afghanistan, etc., now we're seeing those who adhere to this white supremacist ideology, they're going to, for example, Ukraine and Russia to train, or to eastern Ukraine. Talk about why Russia and Ukraine in particular are now epicenters for this ideology and for this new threat.
We are witnessing a lot of people going to Ukraine. We started counting the foreign fighters in Ukraine, specifically those who go there to fight on the front lines. And in a similar manner, when we start counting the jihadis who are going to Syria and Iraq, so far we can count 17,000 from 50 countries. Now, I'm not saying the 17,000 are all white supremacists. There's a lot of people who are going there to protect Ukraine from Russian aggressions. There's a lot of them are going to protect the Russian Ukrainian in eastern Ukraine against Ukraine because they want Crimea to be part of Russia. So people go there for different reasons, very similar to the movement or the influx of individuals who went to Syria at the very beginning. Some of them wanted to fight alongside the Syrian people against a regime, a brutal regime. We've seen the same thing in Afghanistan in the 80s and so forth. But many white supremacists are taking advantage of this conflict in Ukraine in order to build their network, in order to train, in order to develop an international movement. And we've seen it not only on the Russian side, we've seen it also on the Ukrainian side, frankly. You have neo-Nazi organizations, like, for example, the Azov Battalion and others on the Ukrainian side, who established an outreach office. It's called the Western Outreach Office, in a very similar way to how Al-Qaeda established Maktab al-Khadamat. And those guys reach out to similar-minded individuals in the West and try to bring them to Ukraine for training, for indoctrination, for fighting, and so forth. Now, on the Russian side, there's also a group called RIM, Russian Imperial Movement. And the Russian Imperial Movement trying to do the same thing among the white supremacists in the West, bringing them into eastern Ukraine, into Crimea, sometimes into Russia, to give them training, to give them capabilities that they don't have. And a lot of these people are actually from the United States, worked there, coordinated with others there, built friendships over there with other like-minded individuals, came back to the United States, and they actually, some of them organized the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville.
We're, of course, referring to the Unite the Right rally, which was in August 2017, where we had Ku Klux Klan, other neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups confronting peaceful protesters who were there simply to protest the presence of Confederate statues. So again, we had death ensued, and it was a horrible moment in American history. What I want to ask you is, what is it about Russian culture or the Russian government, perhaps? There's a rise of populism. Even here in this country, we're seeing it. Sure. Do we see the connections between the rise of populist governments and movements and neo-Nazi and fascism? Talk about that factor.
Well, I think what we see with the Russians and the white supremacist movement, I think they're just taking advantage of anything they can do in order to create divisiveness in Western societies. And they don't care if it's white supremacists, if it's other groups. They do whatever, and they see what works. And I think it's not a secret anymore that the rise of white supremacy in Western society and far-right groups in Europe has been part of a disinformation campaign by the Russian government, contribute directly to that rise. And that's an assessment by many of the European countries, an assessment by the United States government itself. And I think in the recent strategy of Homeland Security, they mentioned the danger of white supremacist extremism, and also they linked it to Russian disinformation campaign. So I think Russia is trying to do what they can do in order to weaken Western societies. We've seen it in the 2016 election. We've seen it in Europe and France and in England and in Sweden, for example, with their anti-immigration campaign and so forth.
You just said an important word, anti-immigration campaign. And I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about how immigration and the migration refugees who are fleeing conflicts, whether from Syria most particularly, and that this has been an irritant and another factor that has prompted the rise of anti-immigrant sentiment, and immigrants are usually coming from countries, whether in this case Syria predominantly Muslim or along the U.S. southern border, those from Central America, and they are not white or necessarily Christian. And so we're seeing xenophobia and racism on the rise as a result of this anti-immigrant sentiment.
Well, racism and xenophobia is a cornerstone of the white supremacist movement anyway, from the time of Hitler. So I think what we've seen, that movement created some rhetoric, a narrative that the white supremacist movement and those who supported them on social media try to promote in order to bring recruits. For example, we hear about that theory that they came up with, the great replacements theory, that most of Western societies are being replaced by white people. Or in the United States, we hear it as the white genocide. And you see these terms being used in the manifestos of those people who commit crimes, you know, from that movement. And the manifestos, frankly, is now very similar to the martyrdom videos by the jihadis. And we see these terminologies being used. And also at the same time, even the main focus is immigration. But as we've seen in Pittsburgh and other places, they look at few individuals who control the world. Those are Jews. And they are behind replacing white society and diminishing the influence of white people. So it's a Jewish conspiracy. And that's exactly what the criminal terrorists in Pittsburgh basically clearly wanted to do in attacking the synagogue over there, to protest the immigration to the United States, and he believed that the Jews were behind it. They are bringing non-whites to the United States. A lot of people think, well, what is the logic in that? Well, what is the logic in extremism in general? I mean, those guys think that they are under attack. They think that they are trying to promote the idea that the white civilization, the European civilization, is basically under attack by the non-whites and the non-Europeans, and the only way to save it is to create a race war. How do you create a race war? By violence. By copying what ISIS, Al-Qaeda did, so you can have copycats. You will have more people watching these videos, and hopefully they copy what they've seen and they repeat what they are hearing in these manifestos. And that is their strategy that worked for the jihadis, and they are trying to copy it in what they call, I'm not calling that, white jihad.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest is Ali Soufan, former supervisory FBI agent and acclaimed author and CEO of the Soufan Group. That's a strategic intelligence consultancy based here in New York City, and we are coming to you from Soufan Group headquarters in Manhattan. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Kandahar, Afghanistan, Nasir Ahmad. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, Ali, back to you, Ali Soufan. I want to continue our conversation about the rise of radical right extremism, white supremacism. You were on Capitol Hill recently, and of course, there's no question that still we are experiencing a threat from Islamist jihadism. But the statistics show that we are under threat more so from the rise of global white supremacists and their violent tactics, right?
Since 9/11, more people have been killed by white supremacists than by jihadis in the United States. And that trend of violence we've seen and also going up in Europe, in the United Kingdom, in Germany, even our neighbor Canada, they are witnessing a rise in white supremacist violence. And the Canadian government, frankly, designated two domestic groups over there as terrorists, two white supremacist domestic organizations as terrorist organizations. The same thing with the UK. So many of our allies around the world started to look seriously into that problem, and they acknowledge the threat, and they are working the threat in the same way that they work the threats that's coming from the so-called jihadis. We need to do the same.
We need to do more here in the United States. But you did note in your recent report and based on your testimony on Capitol Hill, that the Homeland Security professionals and our Department of Homeland Security has vowed to consider domestic terror legislation.
They do. They actually, in the last strategy that has been released, I think, a few days ago, Homeland Security acknowledged and listed white supremacist threat as a really dangerous threat to the homeland.
Well, that's one important thing. You have to recognize a problem
Absolutely.
Before you come up with
the
a solution.
Absolutely. The first step started with acknowledging.
So that's important. But do you see resources going in that direction? Because up until now, we've been told that a lot of the resources were still being dedicated to fighting foreign terrorism,
right.
And there was a reluctance. But are you seeing a change now?
What I saw when I was in Congress at the Homeland Security hearing, I saw a bipartisan commitment to acknowledge the threat in the same way we are acknowledging the threat of the jihadis. I think both Chairman Thompson and Ranking Member Rogers acknowledge the existence of the threat, acknowledge that they need to work together in order to protect the United States and protect the American people from the threat of white supremacists. That is actually a very good step. It is very rarely these days to see bipartisan support, and I was really optimistic when I saw that bipartisan acknowledgement of the threat and bipartisan commitment to do something about it.
Let's talk about the unique situation in the United States that perhaps precludes us or gives us pause in terms of domestic terrorism.
Sure.
We have this free speech, which is sacrosanct here in the United States. To what extent is that an impediment? Because we're allowed to say just about anything as long as it doesn't harm.
You're not allowed to say anything in the United States. We say that. I mean, if you want to say pro-jihadi, pro-ISIS, pro-Al-Qaeda, the FBI will be on you like white on rice. So you have the right to move your fist in any direction you want, but that right stops when your fist hits my nose. So I think what we need to look into today, we need to look at the violent ideology and the rhetoric that violent ideology is promoting and the violent impact it has on our society. So we're not following ideological narrative if it does not result in violence. It is the violence that we care about. It's the violence that we've seen in El Paso. It's the violence that we've seen in Charlottesville. The violence that we've seen in Charleston. The violence that we've seen again and again and again in different cities in the United States and, frankly, around the Western world. You know, everybody saw what happened in New Zealand in the attack on the two mosques. This is what we need to focus on. There's no freedom of speech that protect this kind of violence. So one of the things that we have a problem here in the United States is convincing lawmakers that we need a domestic terrorism bill. And I don't think there is any will either on the Democratic side or on the Republican side of entertaining domestic terrorism because of what you mentioned, the issues of First Amendment and Second Amendments and so forth.
Second Amendment being the right to bear arms.
To bear arms. So one of the things that we can do, and we mentioned that in our report, is to actually look into designation. Some of these groups have been designated by our allies, have been designated by the Canadians, have been designated by the UK, have been designated by the Germans and so forth. What if we start collecting intelligence and information on those neo-Nazi groups overseas that's recruiting Americans, that's promoting Americans to commit violence, that's training Americans in places like Ukraine or places like East Ukraine in Russia to commit violence in the United States. What if we designate these groups the same way we designate Al-Qaeda and ISIS, this international group? Then all the tools that's available to the FBI, to the intelligence community, to the law enforcement agencies in the United States in combating the violent jihadis can be used in combating the violent white supremacists. So we don't need to do a domestic terrorism bill. We can use the tools that we already have to combat jihadis if we acknowledge that white supremacist groups and white supremacist ideology is an international threat, not a domestic threat. So if we, for example, there's a group called Atomwaffen. Atomwaffen is German, but there is also an Atomwaffen here in the United States. If Atomwaffen is declared a terrorist organization in Germany, why don't we start working with the affiliate that they have here in the United States as a terrorist organization? That gives the FBI, that gives the prosecutors the power to prosecute under material support, bring out material support charges. Today, we don't have charges associated with domestic terrorism in the United States. So that's why the only time you can investigate domestic crime committed by a domestic terrorist in the United States is after the crime happens. You cannot stop them in advance.
usually they're accused of murder.
Absolutely. Even McVeigh, who blew up a whole federal building, they could not file domestic terrorism charges on him. They filed the murder charges on him. And when you hear like an attack on a synagogue or on a mosque, we always call it hate crime. In order to do a hate crime, you need a body. So the FBI, the law enforcement, are not being giving the tools to be preventive. So if you declare the groups overseas that have been recruiting, that have been training, that have been promoting this violent idea of white supremacy in a similar way to the way we look into jihadi groups that promote the idea of jihadi supremacy, then we can actually work them the same way that we work the jihadis.
So have the senior officials in Homeland Security shown themselves receptive to this suggestion and the law enforcement?
Well, we're discussing this idea. We discussed it even in Congress. And so far, our job is to start the discussion, and we never get a pushback yet of this. It seems that that's an idea that doesn't need much to be done except to start collecting intelligence on an evolving threat that's impacting the United States and declaring groups overseas as a terrorist organizations, which gives tools for the FBI and for other law enforcement and intelligence agencies in the United States to work them in the same way they work the Salafi jihadi terrorists like Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
How much of an impediment is it to have a president of the United States, that is Donald Trump, whose rhetoric is either ambivalent or actually stokes the very white supremacist ideology that leads to violence?
Well, the political narrative definitely does not help. And these groups, as we've seen them doing in Europe, as we've seen the jihadis doing in the Middle East, they take advantage of this political and social discourse in order to make themselves more mainstream and more relevant. And I think they are taking advantage of the political and the social reality that we're living here in the United States and trying to benefit from it for their own advantage.
I want to go back briefly to Ukraine. Where are the foreign fighters coming from? You said a lot are coming from the United States. Where else are they coming from, and what's the breakdown?
I think as per our numbers, the United States is not one of the top 10 countries. So most of them are coming from Russia. That's not surprising because of the conflict and the nature of the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Some people are coming from Germany, from Sweden, from Belgium, from Belarus, from Romania, and so forth. I mean, it's mostly a lot of Western and non-Western countries, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth.
They're going to Ukraine. Are there any other places that are becoming epicenters for this ideology and for training and cross-communication?
I think the violent conflict that exists today in Ukraine is kind of like in the middle of Europe. So it's a lot easier for them to go to Ukraine and take advantage of that vacuum in a similar way to how the jihadis go to Syria, for example, or to Sahel region and take advantage of the vacuum that exists over there. But I think we are seeing these groups forming training camps, training here in the United States and other places, forming militias here. We have groups, for example, like RAM, Rise Above Movement. We're also involved in Charlottesville. Three of the members have been indicted by the FBI for trying to orchestrate violence in Charlottesville. They mentioned about at least one of them going to Ukraine, fighting with the Azov battalion and talking about the neo-Nazi nature of Azov and what they are trying to do. So I think the U.S. government is really paying attention to this. I think the government is indicting people, arresting people, but unfortunately there is no tools to effectively prosecute them. When you take them to court and you don't have a domestic terrorism legislation, they are protected by the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. So you actually have to wait until you see a body, and then you do an investigation, and then you try to basically arrest that individual or prosecute.
We'll quickly, as we close, two quick questions for you, Ali Soufan. Going back to Syria, I know you're working on, you know, the foreign fighters, and they have many flocked to Syria, but now supposedly the caliphate has been destroyed, at least physically. But we still have so many ISIS cells there and foreign fighters. Talk about the threat that
you know, I'm glad you asked this question because that shows the complexity of the threats that we're facing. Al-Qaeda today is stronger than they were on 9/11. Al-Qaeda's numbers is probably 100 times more than they were on September 11, 2001, when they did 9/11. ISIS, yes, the physical caliphates have been defeated, but the spiritual caliphate still exists in the minds and in the hearts of so many supporters around the world. Many ISIS members are today in jail in Syria. Remember, we were talking about foreign fighters going to Ukraine. We are the entity that counted foreign fighters going to Syria early on when nobody wanted to hear about it. Our recent count was about 45,000 from 110 different countries. So we have in detention facilities in northern Syria, thousands of ISIS fighters who are in custody. Al Hol camp, there's probably about 70,000 people in that camp. Now, most of them are from Iraq and Syria, but few thousands of them are from Western countries. Now, big percentage of the residents of the whole camp are children under the age of 12. And what do we do with these fighters? What do we do with these children? And what do you do with these women? When it comes to ISIS, women are not usually victims. They are as radicals as the men. And we've seen them in Al-Hol camp trying to reestablish ISIS in the camp itself. So Western countries, at least, need to take responsibility for their own citizens. So far, most of Western countries are putting their head in the sand, thinking like, okay, you know what? I don't want them back. Those guys are dangerous. And this is a very good argument, but it is more dangerous if you don't do anything about it. So Western governments now, they need to basically step up and don't abdicate their sovereign responsibility toward their citizens. And we gave them seven things that they need to do. First, the United Nations have an amazing team investigating the war crimes in Iraq. The UNITAD investigative mandate need to be expand that mandate into Syria. We need to give also the SDF the resources that they need in order to manage these camps. We cannot allow these camps to create the new generation of Taliban. Third, Western government need to start investigating their own people. Send investigative teams to northern Syria, to these SDF camps. Try to develop cases. Try to find witnesses who just want to get out of these camps and they are willing to cooperate with the authorities and tell the truth about other individuals who probably committed crimes. Try to develop these cases. So this is extremely important, and unfortunately, Western governments and European governments are not doing that. Then what you need to do is we need to legislate. Western governments need to legislate. Most of Western governments don't even have material supported charges, so it makes it impossible to prosecute people who are involved with ISIS. And also at the same time, they need to change the sentencing guidelines for crimes like this. So then we have to start thinking about de-radicalization, and especially the children. That child, if you kept them there, they're going to be a terrorist down the road, and they're not going to be in custody forever, and eventually they're going to be released. They are children. They didn't commit any act. But they're going to be more violent than their fathers. So that's why we have to intervene at early stage and de-radicalize these children. And then we have to do reintegration. This is the last point. Reintegration is extremely important, because in reintegration, what happens is you start finding credible voices to tell the communities in Europe about the horrific crimes and their experiences that they had under ISIS. And that will challenge the idea of this spiritual caliphate that ISIS is trying to promote. We need to do all these steps. This is a steps. This is tangible. This is can be done. And at least let's start with the investigative part of their own citizens. And UNITAD, if we expanded their mandate into Syria, can do a lot in providing the evidence, providing the intelligence, providing the documents that might help in the prosecution, in the assessment, in the de-radicalization of a lot of these victims and the non-victims that we have in Syria and Iraq.
So the cooperation of Western governments in order to reintegrate some of these foreign fighters, but under the auspices first of the UN and investigating all these various
steps. Well, first of all, every government need to basically take care of their own citizens.
Sure.
The UN can help with some of the investigations that they are doing. They can share their information with some of these governments. But I think every government should be responsible for their own people, should prosecute their own people. I don't think we here sitting in New York should tell, you know, our friends in Sweden, for example, hey, you need to really reintegrate that family. It's based on their own threat matrix, based on their own assessment of that family. They know if they need to reintegrate it or not. But they need to step up and basically be responsible towards their own citizens. Otherwise, when these people are not in custody anymore, when they go to other areas that's still controlled by ISIS, other ISIS provinces, guess what? They're going to be ISIS 2.0 or ISIS 3.0. And their focus will be attacking the countries where their parents came from.
Ali Soufan is a former supervisory FBI agent. He's an author. He's CEO of the Soufan Group. Ali, thank you so much for a terrific conversation.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in New York City and Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News. I'm David Byrd. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is being asked to explain the sudden